Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A rocky week ends down from major averages, ending a six-week win streak. Economic data continues to drift lower, retail sales and earnings mixed, with a spread of winners and losers. And our guest today is Med Faber, seasoned author, popular podcast host, and CEO and co-founder of Cambria Investments. All this and much more on episode number 638 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm Andrew Horowitz, the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, as well as the founder of Horowitz & Company Investment Advisory. I want to wish you an early, wonderful, and just an absolutely fantastic turkey day. I'll be spending the holiday with my family and a turducken. I hope that you have the opportunity to spend some time, some quality time off with your family and those that really matter the most to you. With that, I just want to mention that the markets will have an abbreviated session this week. U.S. markets will be closed on Thursday and open for a half day on Friday, closing at about, I think it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday coming up. So plenty of time to spend some time with family and really take a little bit of time off, step back, evaluate, relax, maybe see what's going on from a different perspective. Because what we've been seeing is pretty much the market's playing to the same script that we have been seeing for the past month or so. We see this reaction momentarily to negative news about the trade wars and economics, then quickly picking back up as the hope trade is really still there holding strong. And that's really been the overriding way that markets have been playing, because they figure that, you know, if the economic numbers get really too soft, well, the Fed's going to step back in and just fix everything and lower interest rates and maybe even restart some quantitative easing of some sort. We see that the rest of the world is continuing lowering rates, with Mexico and China injecting money into the systems. Of course, Japan holding tight to their continuation of quantitative easing and low interest rates. Europe buying bonds, keeping late rates in the negative zone. So I think the hope trade is alive and well. We did see some economic reports this week that did confirm what I would describe as a gentle slowdown in the U.S., and it's continuing. Housing starts and existing home sales pretty much disappointed. Leading indicators were still in the negative territory, and the new orders component was also showing significant weakness, which goes along with our discussion that there is some implications about with the trade war and how it is now starting to reflect and come over here into the United States and infect our economics. Building permits were an outlier, which was kind of good because that's the first stage of new homes. And we saw a little bit of tick higher there. Overall, the sentiment index from the the University of Michigan, consumer confidence for November, the final reading was 96.8, and that was slightly higher than the initial reading. And that really suggests that spending activity will continue and will have a reasonable, robust holiday season, keeping up with the idea that the consumer is still strong, healthy in the U.S. And that makes sense because we have a good amount of jobs and people working, somewhat seeing a slight movement for wage growth happening. That's all good. On the other hand, we saw that the S&P Retail Index ETF declined about 2.5% for the week. And this was because of mixed results. We saw Home Depot and Kohl's have some problems, but yet Lowe's really did well. We saw at the end of the week, there was some other really good numbers from Nordstrom's, or at least better than expected. So this whole mixture of what's doing well, who's getting hurt, maybe those companies that did a really good job at shifting their supply chains due to the fact that there are these tariffs that are going on right now. Some have done it better, some have done it worse. So we have a very mixed board right now. But clearly the big news of the week, I mean, you have to, you know, wow, this was pretty amazing, where we saw that Charles Schwab is now in talks to acquire TD Ameritrade for about $26 billion. And what this tells us is the zero commissions, that whole plan was possibly a plan to drop down TD Ameritrade, which has about 28% or had 28% of their revenue that was attached to commissions. That really hurt them when they had to follow suit and stay competitive with Schwab when Schwab dropped their rates to zero. Now, Schwab is coming in, and they're just looking to swoop it up, it looks like, for a much better price than they would have gotten otherwise. TD Ameritrade now is trading back up to and maybe even a little bit higher than just before the zero commission announcement happened. So this major consolidation in the industry is going to have a lot of implications because we're already seeing that JP Morgan is changing some of their minimums and their fee structures. Goldman Sachs is thinking about doing something. There's some talk about Goldman Sachs buying another company. Maybe, who knows, E-Trade or some other brokerage that will allow them to stay competitive with this mother of all companies, the Schwab and TD. I don't know what the name's going to be, but pretty impressive. Now, a quick note, you can always get in touch with us or ask a question, and we'll use it potentially on an upcoming episode by going over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, clicking on the Ask Andrew button, and just ask away. You want to send a comment in? You want to ask a question? You want to give us some feedback? Whatever it is, go ahead and do it, because this is a two-way conversation, something we've talked about many times. It's not just us talking about things here. It's also you, the audience, the listener, who helps us really shape what the show is all about. So go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and click on that Ask Andrew button and ask away. So the good news is we finally have nailed down a date. It's today with Meb Faber. We've been going back and forth for a while trying to schedule things, and he has a great podcast and a great following on Twitter and really an incredible amount of quality research that he does on all areas that you really have to pay attention to. But I'm pretty excited that we got Meb on the show today. So how about we get right into that discussion, bring him on, and see what he has to say. It's going to be a fun show. I know it. And our guest today is Meb Faber, and he's co-founder and chief investment officer of Cambria Investment Management. He's also the manager of Cambria's ETFs and separate accounts. And he's the host of the Meb Faber Show podcast and authored several different white papers and leather-bound books. Meb, I like that leather-bound book part.
Thanks. Great to be here. It's a nod to Anchorman. If you've ever seen that movie,
yep.
Very few people get it, but otherwise these bios get a little too boring. Anyway, great to be here.
Hey, thanks. So I thought, listen, you are just a regular in the podcast circuit, and you've done about 190, so I can see, in terms of hosting, back to 2016. So I thought we'd start a little bit differently today to get people and the listeners of my show a little bit more information about who you are. So I thought we'd change it up and kind of have some fun with it. What do you think?
Let's do it.
All right. So here we go. So we'll start with, if you were a superhero, what would describe you best? I'm going to give you choices. This is multiple choice. Home country bias buster, super ETF man, fee drop fury fella, or the asset allocation phantom?
Ooh, that's good. You know, I grew up a Marvel guy. My mom, actually, best mom ever, painted a garage can top. Thing weighed must weigh like 20 pounds for Captain America. So got a great mom, but always been a superhero guy. You know, the first one has got to be up there. It's something I've been preaching pretty hard the last couple years, and it's a regrettable, easy mistake to cure. Last one's pretty good too. If I had to choose, maybe the last one, Phantom. I like that.
The asset allocation Phantom. All right. So we're going to do a quick choice. We're going to do kind of a semi word association, but choose the, the best one that you feel is more appropriate for you. I'm going to start out kind of slow and pick up, okay? Wine All or right. beer?
Beer.
Fake or real meat?
Ooh. Real, but it's
real
close.
Fake. How about real fake meat?
It's close. The Impossible Burger. I'm a little biased. I'm a shareholder, but I think it's on par with most burgers now.
All right. Winter or summer?
Man, these are tough. Slight edge to winter.
Twitter or Facebook? This is probably not hard.
Oh, Twitter.
Yeah. One of my pet peeves with you, and I've kind of gone back and forth. Is it a pod or a podcast?
I mean, the correct term is podcast, but the lingo, I'm a pod. I say pod.
Okay. Fundamental analysis or technical analysis?
This will probably, oh boy. Oh man. I need a little more framing for that, but because we're doing word association, which I'm god awful at, I'm going to go fundamental.
Couple more. Cap weighted or equal weighted benchmarks?
Equal weighted, not even close.
Mutual funds or ETFs?
ETFs.
Trading or investing?
Investing, but there's a lot, like half of these have an asterisk by them, by the way.
I hear you. Domestic or foreign?
Is 2019, 2020, I'm going foreign.
All right. Stocks or bonds?
Stocks.
And finally, growth or value?
Value.
All right. So there you go. You have a little bit more interesting information about who Meb is. And I thought we'd get down to dirty some market talk and just see what's happening out there. And you know, about markets, you do a lot of research. I know that. And you research a lot of different areas. When it comes to valuation these days, this is a big topic because I think at least the idea has gotten muddied a little bit. You know, you have those folks that are saying, you know, hey, valuation doesn't really matter as much because we have low interest rates and all that. And you've had some articles early in the year that you wrote over on your site talking about the spread of valuations, particularly with U.S. and foreign. And I thought we'd talk about that a little bit is, you know, and in the first question, I guess, is one valuation too high and one too low, or is the whole thing just mixed up?
So, and by the way, you got to let me know where I ended up on the ETF Myers-Briggs investor quadrant is kind of weird and crazy.
That's I'll give you the score later. In. Yeah.
So valuations, you know, let's take a step back. And I think this is important because a lot of people are fine not using valuations in their investing approach. And that's a little odd because almost anyone you talk to in the world who spends all day in personal finance, I mean, how many hours do people spend on buying a TV or buying a house or a car? And value is incredibly important on all of those purchases. But when it comes to the stock market, many people just have no interest, and that's somewhat odd. You know, so as you look, the biggest benefit to me about using valuation is it gives you somewhat of an anchor to what is reasonable and what is totally unreasonable. And the vast majority of the time, markets are probably reasonably priced or in that zone. And valuation is something that, you know, if you're doing it out to two decimal places, you're probably doing it wrong because it's a pretty blunt tool. Mm-hmm. And so the benefit of looking back in history is it gives you this fundamental anchor from which to have a framework, which you can say, look at a market and say, hey, this seems good and bad. So, for example, you know, we like using long-term price earnings ratios, but I'll be the first to say that almost any valuation metric when in extremes should agree with all the others. And so we'll use the 10-year price to earnings ratio, which we call the Shiller CAPE ratio. It's nothing more than a 10-year average. It's been around for 100 years. Ben Graham was talking about something similar over 100 years ago where he was averaging out earnings for 5 to 7 years. You adjust it for inflation. But it was recently popularized about 25 years ago by Professor Shiller, now Nobel laureate Shiller, as a metric to really separate the signal from the noise and take a long-term perspective, which is what most people say they want, but often don't act on. So if you look back in history, long-term price earnings ratios, CAPE ratios for stock markets tend to gravitate an average around 17. And the challenge is that over time, and we'll use the U.S. as the first example, you can take it back to the, he takes it back to 1800s. It's been as low as 5 before, and it's been as high as 45 in late 1999, December, my favorite bubble, the internet tech bubble.
That was a fun one. That was fun.
Oh, it was a great one. I was graduating college at the time. People were trading stocks in class. Professors would literally pause, you know, their lecture. They'll go over and check, see what their stocks and IPOs were doing. Great bubble.
I'll just say a quick story about that. That at that time, I knew something was wrong because every time I went to a party or got together with my friends, it was like a mini seminar that they were coming at me and forming like a semicircle around me, asking me questions about, you know, Webvan and Peapod and Netscape. And I mean, I'm like, none of them are earning, not only they're not earning money, they look like they're going out of business. But it was this incredible crush of questions and interest. And, you know, like, oh, my stock went up $45 today. Fantastic. I'm like, okay, that's great. But just realize that, you know, this may not last forever.
It's easy to talk about manias on paper and read them, you know, whether it's extraordinary popular delusions and the madness of crowds, great historical book about popular manias. And to say, you know what, I'll be rational when the next one comes around, but it's really easy to get swept up in it. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to not get swept up in it when all your friends are making money mm-hmm. and making lots of money. So anyway, so that gives you perspective. So had you known that in the 90s, as stocks, you know, had PE ratios that went 25, 30, 35, 40, and you say this is higher than during the roaring 20s bull market, you know, the perspective may have been, you know, maybe it's time not to put all of our chips in the stock market. And the interesting part is that other countries, and we were the first to do this, but plenty of people have done it since. And you can find a lot of these updates for free online now. My pinned tweet on Twitter is a list of valuation resources for these CAPE ratios and others. Other countries have seen even greater examples of booms and busts. So other countries have been even higher than the U.S.'s max of 45, including the biggest bubble we've ever seen, which is Japan in the 1980s, which hit a P/E ratio of almost 100 and was the largest stock market in the world at that time. So it turns out using value to sort or tilt towards countries or markets or stocks works well historically. And I think the thing you mentioned in the beginning of this question was that it's not just that you're investing in the cheap stuff, because that's often hard, but it's also that you're avoiding the really expensive. Mm-hmm. And that's equally as important, to not do the really dumb stuff, like buying these markets when they're trading at P ratios of 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100. A lot of people, you know, they want to focus on the cheap, but it's equally as important to avoid the expensive.
You know, because the other thing is that, you know, obviously nothing happens. You're looking at a 10-year span averaged PE, and obviously nothing, even if it climbs to a pretty high number, it could do that for a period of time because you're looking at a long term. But when they start getting overly done in a comparative basis, and this is kind of what you focused in on, and I know you've been really talking about, particularly when it talks about the home country bias, is that look around the world and there's other places that actually have a much better level of value than we have here in the US as an example. And why aren't you investing there? One of the things I've always talked to clients about was like, yeah, you're afraid of investing in, I don't know, pick a country, you know, let's say China. You're afraid of investing in China because why? You don't know about it. But you know, if you are okay with US, why? Because you're here. And that's where the bias comes in, right? My familiarity with where I am. It feels like it's okay because I'm over here. But if you were a Chinese, you would feel like your market was the place to invest. So, you know, kind of get into the framework. This is a global environment, especially today compared to where it was 25 years ago, where it's much harder to invest.
What we often tell people, and that's spot on, is that, you know, it certainly feels warm and fuzzy. And I think people have a very false sense of competence and security with their home market. They say, well, I really understand these companies. And the question is, do you really, you know, how deep of an understanding do you actually have? But we live in a globalized world, you know, as a framework for the way the world looks, you know, of the market cap of the world. If you ask investors, U.S. investors, say what percentage of your portfolio is of stocks. So ignore everything else, but just stocks, how much is in the U.S.? And almost everyone's right around 80%. And U.S. as a percentage of the world is only about half. So the default index, straight up, you know, starting point should be half. And almost no one does that. And you say, look, let's say you have 70, 80%. First of all, pat yourself on the back, cheers some champagne at the end of this year, decade, because that's been an amazing active overweight for the past 10 years. Well done. But realize you're making a very large active bet on the U.S. And some people know that, some people don't. And if you look at the U.S. on other metrics, U.S. as a percentage of the world, GDP is only about a quarter. Obviously, as a percentage of population, everything else, it's smaller. We say the starting point should be half as now. The problem with market cap weighting that you alluded to in the very first question versus equal weighting is that market cap weighting, which is the market, a lot of people don't know this, and invest in the biggest companies, biggest countries, doesn't have any tether to fundamentals whatsoever. And so if you look at the U.S. right now, if you look at these CAPE ratios, we track 45 countries around the world. The bad news is the U.S. is one of the most expensive. So it trades at a long-term P ratio of around 30. Again, it's not crazy. It's not a bubble, in my opinion. But it simply means future expected return should be probably low single digits. And oddly enough, John Bogle, before he passed, actually had a similar statement. Now, the good news is the rest of the world is pretty reasonable. So foreign developed is down around 20. And even better, foreign emerging is down around 15. Now, if you carve out the cheapest of the cheap countries, the detritus at the bottom of the ocean that's really cheap, you get down to a PE ratio of down around 11. But, and there's a big, huge but with capital letters, the challenge with that, and one of the reasons probably why it works too, is those countries are dominated by the worst of the nastiest of the grossest geopolitical news, economic news. And so you look at this basket and people get off this podcast and say, okay, what Meb have to say? They say, well, he says the cheapest countries are Russia and Greece and Brazil, and let's sprinkle in a little Turkey. And that's a really nasty bucket to be buying. But a big takeaway of this too is that when you're buying low PE ratio, it's really the numerator that moves. The reason they're low P ratio is because these stock markets are down 40, 60, 80, 90%. And the reason often that the P ratio is higher on things like the U.S. Is that they're hitting all-time highs. And so usually buying a basket of the cheaper things and avoiding the expensive stuff has worked out over time. But the key being a basket, you can't just go buy one country because you'll have some major separation like this year. I think Russia's up over 30 and Greece is, I think Greece is up near 50 this year. But some of that is masked by the fact the U.S. is also romping and stomping up, I don't know, 20 some percent. So tilting away from the expensive and toward value is a big deal, particularly right now, remember, where we're ending the decade with the U.S., most U.S. investors investing 80% in the U.S., which also happens to be one of the most expensive countries in the world. Rewind to 1980s, the biggest country market cap in the world was Japan, trading a P ratio of 100. So if you didn't have a valuation anchor or tether, you would put most of your money in the country trading at a P ratio of 100. And does that check any common sense, reasonable bucket? It doesn't. So I think, you know, as the decade winds down, it's important to be thoughtful of these valuations and have a exposure that's not to just the U.S.
And that brings up the whole, you touched on this, but the benchmark game, the whole idea that the S&P 500, the NASDAQ are, you know, market cap weighted. And if in fact we have such an exposure to the U.S. and if we are benchmarking, therefore we have an extraordinary exposure to the largest companies, the Facebooks, the Apples, the Microsofts and all that. This week, Howard Silverblatt over from S&P 500, the keeper of the data, came out with a list that the top stocks that were producing returns, inclusive of Apple up 70% for the year and Facebook up 50% and all that, 29% of the performance of the S&P 500 was due to these 10 stocks out of 500 stocks. So the weighting game, you know, when I say weighting with the weight as in heaviness, you know, is a little bit of a skewed dynamic. Better than price weighted by a million miles, right? But I still don't understand why we have this need to have this cap weight. And then we have the preponderance of ETFs that are index-based and passive investing in that. It kind of doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, so the market cap weighting, look, if you go back 50 years, there was a massive bomb that went off in the investing industry that had repercussions and still is going on for 50-plus years. And a lot of people mistake it, thinking that it was indexing and market cap weighting. I take the minority view that that actually wasn't the huge innovation. And John Bogle and Wells Fargo, Vanguard, others really built this out. So indexing in the 1970s meant one thing. It meant market cap weighting. And the innovation was not that you were indexing and market cap weighting. It was that all of a sudden, because you're doing nothing, market cap weighting means you literally do nothing. It has like 5% turnover, and that's really just corporate actions. You were then able to offer it for a very low fee. So that became the benchmark, and it's great. I mean, it's been a fantastic development, but market cap weighting is a very curious way to go about investing. If you were to ask an alien or someone who took a step down and said, you know, is this a reasonable way to invest where you just put only one variable, technically two, it's just price of the stock times the shares outstanding. Like, that's a weird way to invest. Now, The reason it works is you're guaranteed to own the winners. And what we know from stock distributions, they often follow, or they follow a power law. So almost all the returns come from these massive success stories, the McDonald's, the Walmarts, the Amazons, the Apples. But it's like 2/3 of stocks underperform the index over time. About half have a zero rate of return, and about a quarter straight up go to zero. And so market cap weighting guarantees you own those, but it's fairly suboptimal and it exposes you to booms and busts. So if you look at market cap weighting in the late 90s and other times, these very strong outperformers that get expensive, and it's not always the case, means that market cap weighting can get distorted by what's underneath the surface. And, you know, you mentioned whether you call that active or passive is somewhat meaningless to me, but any approach other than market cap weighting should likely beat market cap weighting by about a percent or two over time, is my belief. And there's a great, we tweeted this the other day, a great study by Research Affiliates where they talk about historical simulations where if you look at the largest stock in the stock market at the time, it's the biggest. So right now, is that Apple, Amazon? I'm not sure.
It's Apple.
$1 trillion stock, right? Yeah. But if you look at the largest stock when it's the largest, historically, it underperforms the market by about 3 percentage points per year for the next decade. And then that's true across sectors. It's true across countries. And the reason being is simply capitalism and just law of gravity, where by the time you get to be the largest stock, it's often because the price has gone up, the stock's expensive, but also that capitalism comes along and there's some other company who says, you know what, we'd love to be a $1 trillion company too. And creative destruction happens and it creates a situation where these top market cap weighting tend to underperform. So the best thing you can do is just avoid the biggest, but any other weighting methodology tends to outperform that over time. But, you know, again, but the caveat is market cap weighting can go long periods where it stomps everything else, which is kind of the case right now, as you mentioned.
So let's kind of shift gears a little bit to, I know a lot of things that you've talked about in the past have been about, listen, why pay extraneous fees for something if you don't have to? I mean, I think that's a good statement that you've made, or something is paraphrasing some things you've said in the past, right?
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay. What do you make about this, and what do you think about this whole race to the bottom with commissions? I mean, is it good for investors or just another ploy to make commissions less transparent?
So you got to remember, Wall Street is not a nonprofit. Everything about Wall Street is designed certainly to take your money. But let's be clear, there's never been a better time in history to be an investor. If you want, if you so choose, at the end of 2019, you can have a brokerage account that pays no commissions. You can have a cash balance, if you're thoughtful, that gets a reasonable rate of return, whatever it is now, 1.5%, 2%. if you so choose. And that's actually how most brokerages make money. And a lot of people don't know that. Schwab makes probably half, over half its money from simply the interest on the account. And a lot of people, if you look at your Bank of America account, you look at your brokerage account, actually don't know what they're getting paid. So go look it up. The answer is probably zero. But they are happy to take advantage of your laziness for not knowing. But it, you could certainly open an account in plenty of places that's totally insured that it will pay close to 2% today. But that's, again, you have to be on top of it. And then if you wanted to buy a portfolio of buy and hold, market cap weighted, global portfolio, and again, the global market portfolio is about half U.S., half foreign, and it's about half stocks and half bonds. That costs about 5 basis points today. So you can buy some ETFs that are tax efficient, 0.05%. And if you include the short lending on that portfolio is already probably at zero, if not negative expense ratio, which is pretty amazing time to be alive as an investor. That having been said, the vast majority of the world doesn't do that. You know, the average fees of mutual funds and you go up from there, you know, charge 1-2% plus. Many of these are, you know, what you'd put under the category of closet indexers. They say they're active, mm-hmm. but they really aren't.
Right.
You know, you end up getting the S&P for 2 percentage points. And that's the way most of the world's still invested. There's in the buy and hold asset allocation mutual fund category, there's still well over $1 trillion invested there, despite the fact that you don't have to pay that. So the base case scenario we often tell people is your sort of like asset allocation for dummies, the bar of which you have to decide to pay more is the global portfolio for free and no commissions, high cash balance. Now, does that mean that it's not totally justifiable to pay more for certain strategies and ideas? Absolutely. You know, one of my favorite books of the year is The Man Who Solved the Market.
You know, by the way, I thought you were going to mention that somewhere here because everybody seems to be mentioning that was an incredible marketing push. I've got 2 books. I don't know how many you got. They sent me 2.
It's a good book.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a story of a probably arguably the world's greatest hedge fund manager, Jim Simons, who was a mathematician, who charged just ridiculous fees. And there's lots of other good parts about the book. The human element of managing money and imposter syndrome, not thinking you're a good man, all these things wrapped in. Anyway, it's a fun book. But the point being is that you can pay high fees if you find something that's worth it, but most things aren't. And it's by definition rare to find that sort of alpha and benefits. Obviously, we're an ETF manager that charges higher fees than zero. So yeah, we believe.
Yeah, no, but you know, there's something to be said. No, but there's something to be also said about what other services are involved. If all you want is buying and selling and you can do it yourself, well, okay, then do it yourself. If you want someone there for a lot of different reasons, not just simply maybe just performance, but it's also there's other things wrapped up into it, I mean, you pay a little bit more. I don't have an objection to that. The question, though, is really, and by the way, let me back up. You mentioned like a Schwab portfolio where you're making possibly zero, and that's where Schwab makes their money. So Schwab makes their money on cash reserves. So does TD and E-Trade and all this. They make their money on the cash reserves or the cash sweep account. What you could simply do is if you decide for whatever reason that you want to have a cash balance, move it into one of the money purchase funds or move it into something else. The money purchase funds in Schwab are yielding anywhere from 1.5 to 1.7%. It just means you have to move them around a little bit more. It's not as easy to just buy and sell inside your portfolio. But you can make, if you're committed to keeping cash for a while, a whole lot more money on your money. So
well said.
But the thing is, this lack of transparency, because they're not doing this out of the goodness of their heart either. They're going to be selling the flow. And, you know, I'll take you one step further on this. The recent announcement that Schwab will be looking into merging, buying TD Ameritrade, I thought that was kind of interesting because it happened so soon after the announcement that Schwab was going to zero commissions, which Schwab only had about 8% of their overall revenue from commissions, while TD had like 28%. Cracked the stock pretty good. TD Ameritrade stock was down like 35, 40%. And then here comes the white knight after that. Hey, you know what? Why don't we take you over? I wonder if it was a bit of one of the greatest schemes out there to.
Yeah, that having been said, I mean, I agree with you. It's a tough business to be in. I mean, we said a lot of the traditional brokerage business and frankly, asset management industry too, is going to come under enormous pressure from technological developments. I mean, in a world where commissions are free and you don't have to let your money sit in cash balance at zero, that's a hard business to survive in for them. And same thing for asset management, for these funds that still charge a lot for doing nothing. That's a terrible business going forward. But guess what? You know, of the 160 odd industries in the U.S., the highest profit margins are up there is asset management.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's a lot of fat to be cut, and you know that benefits all of us. But it'll be curious to see how it all plays out. I think it's going to be a really tough business going forward for sure.
Let's talk a little bit about current market outlook. I put three drivers that I've been kind of thinking about, and like, you know, what's driving the markets? What is it that you can't all of a sudden? We've gone from Momo to FOMO. We've gone from fear to greed. We've gone from kind of like, okay, valuations, all right, you know, and maybe there's some concern about recession to, everything's going to play out, Brexit, all this. The three drivers that I've kind of identified, see if you agree with this, is we have the Fed. The Fed now has our back. You know, the Fed is now, they're no longer going to raise rates and, you know, they're probably going to sit tight. We have central banks around the world that are easing. We have quantitative easing around the world. It was restarted by Europe. We have a mini QE here by the Fed in the repo market, even though they said it's not a QE. We have hopes of a trade deal with China that we're on the doorstep one day and the next day it's not happening. And we have consumers. Consumers are the backbone, the service index, you know, and the ISM has been holding up even though manufacturing's in recession. What are your thoughts kind of on where we are in a much shorter term, but you know, what else is driving this market right now?
We like to kind of like take a step and back and look around at the landscape. And if we know anything about asset classes and performance, it's that every asset class, and this is hard, by the way, most people want to be cheering for their investment approach. You got gold bugs, you got dividend guys, you got 60-40 people, whatever it may be, the crypto, blockheads, everything, is that it's hard to be asset class agnostic. And so to not put all your bets on one horse. And so we know that every asset class has its time in the sun and other times where it's absolutely terrible. And reflecting back on this past decade has been a unique one in that the U.S. stock market has stomped nearly everything else. And as you take a look around and see what's done very poorly, certainly my favorite idea for the next decade is emerging markets. That's something that most people have totally abandoned, and God forbid commodities. That's been something that has just been awful.
That's brutal.
Yeah. And so, but these things have a way of, you know, cycling in and out of favor. I mean, the U.S., if you look back at the past 11 decades, this was in the top five as far as real returns. But also it's ending at one of the most expensive. But the trends, like you said, the trends have been up for a lot of these markets, with the exception of commodities. This has been also a great year for real estate and bonds. And in many ways, a kind of a mirror image of last year, where kind of everything was down. This year is everything is romping and stomping. So, you know, my belief is that it's imperative to come up with a strategy that should do well in any environment. The actual catalysts, I don't know. They're often obvious in retrospect, and you and I could have a coffee or beer together and gossip about them, but that's the beauty of being a quant, is yeah. I let the signals tell me and dictate what to do. But as we're ending the year, it's still been a story of a lot of momentum and strength in the U.S. stock market. At some point, that'll change. This should be the first decade in history that the U.S. market hasn't had a recession, where first time in history, 2017, the market was up every single month in the year. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing a lot of interesting firsts, but you got to remember that's not normal. Bridgewater has a great piece on geographic diversification that talks about this, and it's pretty rare for the U.S. to outperform as much as it has over the past 120 years this decade. So, you know, as we end 2019, I would certainly be placing my chips in places that no one wants to be.
You know, just to, I'm going to pick your brain about something, then just to have one more follow-up. Quantitative investing, you know, the idea of using, no emotions, screening processes and all this to kind of tell you, lead you, right? You know, it's giving you the information. We have a screen that we use for one of our portfolios and really kind of, you know, change a little bit here and there just to keep up with things, not to change it because we want something to change, right? To make sure we're right in line with things. What's interesting is that usually out of the list of, you know, 5,000 stocks that we start with, we pare it down. Usually about 50, 60 stocks come through that screen. Okay, it's a growth screen. And we use margin, expansion of margin. We want to see, you know, expansion of EPS, expansion of revenue, a high ROE, you know, about 15 different fundamental data points, some volume data points, a few other things to give us this list. What's interesting is in the last 6 months, we've only gotten 30 names. And that's making us kind of worry that, hey, what's happening here that all of a sudden, and meanwhile, the market keeps on moving and grooving, but what, you know, what do you do with something like that? You know, do you say, well, you know, just going to let the thing run and do its thing. Therefore you have a lower allocation to particular, you know, to particular sector or to the portfolio for your equity exposure. That's how we do it. You know, we kind of naturally reduce it.
I think the benefit of being quant, and when I say quant, all I mean is being rules based.
Yeah,
and having, some non-discretionary rules to guide your, belief system, because I often smile when I'm talking to people and they say, oh, you know, you're a quant or whatnot. And I say, well, what's the alternative? The alternative is just to wing it,
see the pants.
Yeah. And so as we know, my favorite sentiment study, that's almost too bad to make up, it should have been in The Onion, is that if you look at the AAII, American Association of Individual Investors survey that goes back to the 1980s, they asked people, you know, are you bullish, neutral, or bearish on the stock market? And when were people most bullish? It was literally the worst time, the single worst month in history to be bullish, December 1999. Mm-hmm. And the time when most people were bearish was March 2009. Like, you can't make that up. It's exact opposite of what it should be.
But everybody does know at this point that is a contrarian indicator.
Yeah, and the emotions creep themselves, have a way of creeping in, and that causes fractures and bad behavior. And a lot of that comes from the fact that people often haven't studied history and their expectations are out of line with what's possible. And yeah. So it's good to have a quant framework as at least like the base case policy portfolio and understand what's possible and what's not. So then when something really bad happens, you have the reference to say, okay, is this normal? This has happened before. This is how I should behave that I shouldn't. That having been said, it's also useful to understand and have a discretionary view of markets and say, okay, well, is there a situation where something has changed or this time is different? And often the case is no. But there are times when something is different. So an example would be how U.S. companies in the early 1980s shifted due to a new rule passing a lot of their cash flow distributions to shareholders from dividends to buybacks. And that's been a big trend over the past 40 years, 50 years. And starting in the late 90s, buybacks, net buybacks, eclipsed dividends as a way to distribute cash to shareholders in any given year and in aggregate. And had you not understood that sort of very real structural change, you would have continued doing things in the old way, which would have been suboptimal. The same thing applies globally. For example, you know, we use multiple valuation metrics, kind of what you mentioned, a multi-factor model rather than just one, because certain ones can bias you towards a various market or regime. Good example would be Australian companies are incentivized to pay out higher dividends because there's a beneficial tax treatment. So if you just sorted on dividends, you would often end up with a bunch of Aussie companies. Mm-hmm. And that's could be for better or for worse, but at least understanding that. So I think it's useful to have some perspective and common sense as well. But, you know, what you're talking about, I think in many ways is a good indicator of what the world looks like, because I think in the US, you have a scenario where, you know, every market is like a swarm of bees. So in the late 90s, that was very much a market cap tech, biotech, IT sort of mania. Dividend stocks, value stocks, didn't have a bear market for the most part. They sailed right through 2000, 2003. It's a little different now.
But 97 to 99 was not good for them.
Oh, man. I think
that was rough for value.
I think Buffett underperformed the NASDAQ in one 12-month period by 150 percentage points.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not 150 basis points, 150 percentage points.
Exactly.
You know, and so I smile because if you look at now, I think it's a scenario where that swarm of bees looks different in that across the board, everything is more expensive. So it's not as that it's a pure one sector crazy mania. It's more that everything has risen in sort of general price. And so that might be why your screens are saying, hey, look, there's just less candidates out there. And then that you see the reverberations in a lot of places in private equity. For the first time, you see the multiples on private equity companies. Historically, they've been a discount for being illiquid, but now they're the same price as public markets, if not more expensive. So you see these echoes and shadows of what's going on, and that may be what your screen's picking up.
Yeah, it could be. Before we go, I want to mention that information on how to contact Meb about his firm, everything's going to be on the show notes for episode number 638. By the way, we've got 638 episodes of this baby under wraps. Once a week, missed 2 weeks in the last 10, 12 years.
Incredible. Well done.
Yeah, thanks. And the other thing I want to mention is on your site, I know you have a free book called Global Asset Allocation, a survey of the world's top investment strategies. How do we get a copy?
You just go to the website, type in your email address. You actually will, I think, end up getting three. It's a bundle of three of our books. It's either on mebfaber.com or cambriainvestments.com. It's on both spots.
And you can also go to iTunes and any other pod directory. And you can just look up Meb Faber and check out his podcast. He has an unbelievable list of guests and a depth of information. His reviews are great, great stuff, a real asset for the podcast community that we've been building for the last, I don't know, you know, decade plus. So thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
It's been a lot of fun. Let's do it again sometime in the decade to come.
That sounds great. And thanks again for joining us. Oh, that was great. Well, I thought it was going to be great. You know, when you have somebody who's a seasoned podcast host on your show, they kind of understand the flow and how things go and all that. But really just, wow, what a wealth of information. And I think that was much better than I think one of the best shows we had in a while. Hopefully you appreciated that. You think the same thing. You can get all the information about Meb on the show notes for episode number 638 over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So check that out and find out more about that. Get those free books. He said there's three of them right now. So anyway, we're going to end it right there. And hope you have, again, a wonderful Thanksgiving leading up into the holiday season, into the end of the year, into Christmas and Hanukkah and Kwanzaa, all that good stuff. So anyway, we're going to end it right there. And thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you again next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.